The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. So one of the wonderful things about hosting this show is the fact that we get emails from listeners. Many emails from many listeners. And some of these emails contain ideas for show topics. And some of these show topic ideas fall into the controversial category. Now, occasionally that's because the science is in dispute, but often it's because it's a political or media-driven debate, and people want help trying to separate the facts from the hyperbole. And we are happy to provide our assistance. In the past, we've done episodes on climate change, nuclear power, research ethics, and the surprisingly contentious show on transhumanism. And today we'll add genetically modified foods to that list. In a moment, we'll be joined by Kevin Folta, professor and researcher in plant genomics at the University of Florida. But first, to speaking up.
Go, super scientist, go. Break that code. Go, super scientist, go. Find your answer.
I'm here with Monty Harper, a children's songwriter in Stillwater, Oklahoma. He's published 7 CDs for kids, and he's been performing professionally for 20 years. Welcome, Monty.
Thank you, Desiree. Whenever I hear you call out for people who have a creative way to teach science to kids, I always think, she's talking to me, and now I get to be on the show.
Brilliant. Actually, back in 2008, you started an event called the Born to Do Science Cafe.
That's right. I had heard about science cafes, and as a children's performer and science fan, naturally I thought, well, do they do this sort of thing for kids? And I looked into it. I didn't see any cafes anywhere that were aimed at children. So I thought, well, I'm going to try to do this and see how it goes. So it's a monthly event, and I bring in a scientist each month and have them talk to the kids about their research.
So where does the music come in then?
Well, what I do is I interview the scientists ahead of time, and I really get to know all the details about what they're studying and how they go about it. And I write a song based on that. And then at the beginning of the event, I'll sing the song as an introduction to the topic and sort of a way to get everybody relaxed and ready to talk about science.
And how did the kids respond?
The kids are great. We have the smartest kids who come to these. They ask all kinds of really wonderful questions, and they just have a good time. One of the challenges that I face in putting these programs together is that we're talking about actual scientific research to 3rd through 5th graders who may not have the background. So if we're talking about bacteria and proteins and things like this, they may not know what those things even are. And so when I have the scientists say, well, we're asking this question, blah, 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 the kids may not even be able to appreciate the question because they don't have the background information. A lot of times adults will say, well, why aren't the kids just lost and confused? You know, because we're trying to talk about things they don't have the background for. And kids are used to not understanding what adults are talking about anyway. They just think it's really cool that a scientist is talking to them about their work. And I try to set up each event so that it includes some hands-on things the kids can do, something they can manipulate, look at, images on the screen they can look at, and other things to keep them hooked. And I also try to plan out the program so that there are times where the kids get to think about what's going on and come up with their own solutions. So we would say, you know, here's a problem we're working on. What would you do? And they'll come up with some of the coolest ideas, and I'll have the scientists respond to those. So it's very interactive. And the kids, I get their feedback at the end of each program. Often they say they didn't understand it, but always they say they want to come back. So I don't think it really matters how much they get out of it in terms of being able to regurgitate the information. What I'm really trying to do is inspire them to want to know more and inspire them to see science as something that's relevant and exciting and important and scientists as real people who are approachable, and science is something that you can understand if you give it a little bit of effort.
I find that really interesting because it seems like not only the events that you're holding, but your songs as well, they're not just focused on the product of science. You're talking about the process. You're talking about critical thinking.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I'm not trying to teach curriculum with these songs. I became interested in doing science songs as a topic through listening to lots of podcasts like yours, where people are saying kids need more things that get them interested in science. And so I looked into writing songs about it. And there are a lot of songs out there already that cover the curriculum, and they cover cool facts about science. And I thought, you know, what's missing in this picture is the other end of the equation. What do scientists actually do? What are the frontiers of science? What's going on now? What do we not know? And that's really way more interesting to me in terms of finding things to write about that are emotional and just hook your interest and make you want to know more. So I'm really focused on what these scientists are doing.
So your music is somewhat similar to They Might Be Giants then?
Well, I'd say it is. Definitely they're an influence. I've been listening to them since the Flood album, and I actually was working on my science CD before they came out with theirs, but I really love their CD. I would say that kids who enjoyed the They Might Be Giants CD, Here Comes Science, will probably graduate from that CD to my CD. Mine is aimed more at the 8 to 12 age range. And so once they're a little older, I think they'll enjoy mine. So.
And yours has a bit more detail in terms of the technical aspects of it as well.
Definitely. I love to find that one central idea, and then I hang all kinds of geeky details off of that idea. So there are lots of big sciencey words in there. It's a lot of fun.
So do you have any kind of science background?
Not really. I do have
you and me both, sir. So.
I have a mathematics degree. I have my master's in math. But I've just always been interested in science. And you know what? I feel like my education sort of let me down, because at the end of high school, going into college, thinking, you know, what do I want to do? I'd always been really interested in science and really good at it. I did really well in science throughout school. But I came out with the impression that it was all done and there wasn't room for any new contributions, which is really mind-blowing that you could come out thinking that. And I think it's because, you know, I'm in high school science. You do a chemistry lab experiment and you can look the answer up in the back of the book, what you're supposed to come up with. And you read the textbooks that it's all about, you know, the golden age of science when people could discover new things in their garage about magnetism and things like that. Well, it's all been done. You know, what's left to do? Nobody taught me what was going on in science at the time or what the current questions or problems were. And it didn't occur to me that there were any. Then as an adult, you know, I started reading magazines and listening to podcasts and finding out that there's all kinds of new stuff going on all the time. And that got me excited about it again.
So did you have to do your own research then so that you could translate it into kid?
Well, I've been writing songs for kids for 20 years. And so I kind of do know how to take a topic and boil it down to like the one thing. A song is always about one thing. It's a very short form of writing. You get maybe 3.5 minutes to say what you need to say. So you need to focus down onto one idea. And I've done a lot of nonfiction songwriting for kids over the 20 years. And so it's a skill that I have. I'm a pretty smart guy. I like to think I am. And so, you know, when I interview the scientists, I really make sure that I understand what they're talking about. As a, you know, I said, I have my master's in math. I also taught math at the college level for a while and noticed that a lot of people aren't aware whether they know something or not. They can listen to a lecture and say, oh yeah, I understand that, and be wrong. They didn't understand it. So that's a skill. It's a skill that I think I have. So I ask really good questions and I make sure I understand it. And then I can boil that complicated bunch of information down into one strong idea that I could put into a song.
A song that's actually enjoyable and interesting for children to listen to.
Well, I hope so.
Because that's really the key here.
Well, the other skill I have is just knowing kids. I've been working with kids all my professional life. So, you know, I know what makes them tick, what grabs their interest. And, you know, I'm always, well, I'm talking to scientists, but part of my brain is thinking, okay, kids are going to be lost by that. Kids will care about that. Ooh, this aspect. this thing right here. Kids will go, you know, will love to hear that. So I could focus in on the thing that appeals to kids about it.
So now what you're doing is crowdsourcing funding to make a CD called Songs from the Science Frontier.
That is correct. I put my page up on Kickstarter.com, and Kickstarter is a website that's designed to help creative people raise the money they need to do their creative projects. And the idea is to collect lots of small contributions from many people. So I have a goal, and I need to reach that goal by August 21st. If I reach the goal, I get the funding, and if I don't, I get nothing.
So people pledge, but they don't donate at that time?
That's correct. Basically, Kickstarter is just adding up pledges, and a pledge is just a promise. So you're just promising to pay that amount. If I reach my goal in pledges, then they will actually charge people's credit cards for the money. But if I don't, you don't end up paying anything.
And what's going to happen with these CDs?
If you pledge, I think it's $20 or more, you get a copy of the CD for yourself. You can also designate that your CD should go to a school. So I think I have about enough for 30 or so CDs so far that are going to just be donated to schools or other places where lots of kids will get to hear them.
So what else can people get with their pledges?
There are various awards that you can receive depending on how much you pledge, from the CD itself to what else? I'm offering a session with me online, and that can be for a classroom, talking about science or talking about songwriting or whatever you want. And a performance, you can get me to come to wherever you are and perform the songs live. And the very top tier, if somebody has $2,000 to blow, is a song. I will write a song about any science topic that you want. If you're a researcher, I can write about your research and put that song on the CD. So I have two slots for that.
And you're trying to raise $9,000, correct?
Yes. And none of that money goes in my pocket, because
right,
that's all expenses related to recording the CD, hiring musicians and studio time and a producer and all of that stuff.
So what are you at right now?
I am halfway there. I'm just a little more than halfway there right now. And I think the average pledges have been very generous. I'm just blown away by how people are sort of getting behind the idea of it and donating more money than they need to get the reward that they want. And so I'm thinking I need maybe 80 more people to become backers, and I'll reach my goal.
I absolutely know from experience that Skeptically Speaking listeners are quite generous. They've been generous to me. Again, where can people go to pledge?
People can go to montyharper.com. That's MontyHarper.com. And there will be a link there right on my front page to the Kickstarter project.
Perfect. And best of luck. Great idea.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking right after this.
Pseudomonas originosa, bacteria that seem to do no harm, but then a secret message signals them to form a biofilm, and they organize a syndicate, invincible and poisonous, and none can stop their deadly tricks. None but the super scientist. Go, super scientist, go. Break that code. Go, super scientist, go. Find your answer. Do the things you need to do to make the data speak to you. Go, super scientist, go. Change the world.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Dr. Kevin Folta, Associate Professor in the Horticultural Sciences Department at the University of Florida. Kevin studies the genomics of horticultural crops, and he's authored over 50 scholarly reviews, research articles, and book chapters. And he also has a rather intense interest in promoting science to the public. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Hi, thank you, Desiree.
So back on episode 12, we talked to Chris McDonald, who writes about biotech ethics, but we couldn't really get into the science of it. And the subject of genetically modified food is definitely one of those where we see a lot of discussion of both the science and of the ethics. So why is that?
I think it's because it's changing food. It's something that's very near and dear to all of us and something we're all dependent upon and something that we hold really internally very sacred. So alteration of food seems to be something that is intrinsically maybe wrong. The problem is that it's a problem, a fear of convenience, that we have plenty of calories here and always seem like we will. So that's kind of where it starts to become a problem with me, because we have to think with a little bigger latitude in terms of other people, but also time, what we'll do in the future.
So when we talk about genetically engineered food, we usually think about gene splicing and glow-in-the-dark tomatoes and that kind of thing. But really, that's only the most recent form of genetic modification.
Well, that's genetic modification where there has been human intervention and moving of, say, a single gene or small suite of genes from one species to another, or within one species, one plant to another. But genetic modification has been going on since the dawn of agriculture, probably about 16,000 years ago. Virtually everything we eat, whether it's corn or soybeans or anything, is been highly genetically modified. It's not genetically modified in the parlance of the usual Frankenfood discussion. What it means typically is that wild species that had some sort of value to early hunters and gatherers were brought together, and selection took place. The best plants every year were brought forward into the next. The best seeds from the best plants were brought into the next year and the next generations. At times, there may have been outcrossing with other species that have been nearby or maybe very distant. This maybe brought even better hybrid vigor to these plants. So what we're looking at today in terms of modern food is an extensive demonstration of the power of breeding and the power of human intervention in creating better plant products. When you look at things like bananas, for instance, especially like maize, cotton, all of these have been highly genetically modified ever before a single gene was spliced.
So we've already received a question from the chat room.
From Dame J, when did the idea of genetic modification make the change from acceptable selective breeding, which we've been doing for ages, to evil Frankenfood?
Yeah, I think the major public cry to this happened probably in the mid-1990s, and the place that really was the milestone for me was the successful development of the Flavor Saver tomato, which was intended to allow better tasting tomatoes by controlling the ripening process. And that's what really put it on the radar screen for most people. Maybe the idea that it was a tomato, which is something we all really relate to, is that very comfortable comfort food of a fresh tomato from the garden, may have been a bad first choice. But that was the one that really brought it to my attention, and maybe for most people as well.
So what are the methods that we're using right now for this?
Well, the methods that are used in genetic modification in the laboratory are based upon the idea that it's very easy to exploit a process or a property of plants or plant cells called totipotency. And any of you who've taken a cutting from one plant and taken the cutting and stuck it in soil or placed it in water and saw that the cells on the stem could now take on the identity of roots or characteristics of root cells and emerge from that stem and now give this plant a new root system, basically the plasticity of plant cells, that they can take on other identities. What this allows us to do in the laboratory is take cells from, say, a leaf or a stem cutting and introduce the gene into those cells. Then once those cells have been have been transformed, as we say, with the new gene of interest, we can create an entire new plant from that single cell by exploiting that same exact process. The way we get the gene in is done through using what is called Agrobacterium tumefaciens. Agrobacterium is a naturally occurring soil bacterium, and it's the bacterium that produces the crown galls, or the large, almost tumor-like protuberances on plants, naturally in the wild. What science has done is, the reason that, bacteria can do this is because it takes some of its genes, and these are naturally occurring, it takes some of its genes and transfers them to the plant cell, and now hijacks the plant cell to create products that help it become, make it more hospitable for the bacterium to survive. What scientists have done is removed the payload that the bacterium usually uses to exploit the plant, and allows scientists to place the genes into the context of the bacterium that now allow the bacterium to deliver the genes that we want delivered. So it's essentially us taking these plant cells, mixing them with this bacterium that can do the genetic exchange, and putting them together, and then regenerating plants from the cells that are transformed or have received the new gene from the bacterium.
So now, what kind of genes would you want delivered and why?
Well, if we think about this in the context of modern agriculture, we're looking at two major problems. And the problems are sustainability and also productivity. And the two tend to be thought of as mutually exclusive. How do we grow? The reality is that we have increasing populations. We have more demand for fresher, better food grown with less environmental impact, with better safety for workers, maybe with available through more seasons so we can realize fuel costs. So what are genes that can help us do that? What are genes that can be introduced to allow plants to survive in inhospitable areas, maybe to help farmers who currently can't grow plants in their area because of arid or salinated soils, maybe because of cold or heat tolerance. These would be, so any genes that could confer a greater level of fitness to those plants, allow them to grow where they don't grow now, and be able to grow with less environmental impact.
Now, are you just speaking of interplant species cross-engineering, or are you talking about other species as well, like inserting animal genes?
Well, traditionally, it's been a little mixture of both, but certainly the classical example might be thought of as herbicide-tolerant plants. Herbicide-tolerant plants, or the Roundup-ready varieties, they key off the idea that there is an herbicide which is toxic to a plant enzyme. This enzyme that we typically call EPSPS, this enzyme is sensitive to glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup. The bacterial version of that same enzyme tolerates the glyphosate. It is not inhibited. It's an essential enzyme. So if you can add the bacterial version of that to a plant, now you can confer resistance to that herbicide to the plant. And that's exactly what they did to make Roundup Ready crops. In other cases, we can take an improved allele of a plant gene, a gene variant of a plant gene, or possibly a gene that's already in the plant and just express it in a different context. Maybe it's a gene that confers resistance to a given disease or maybe tolerance to stress. And instead of just expressing it in, say, a fruit, expressing it throughout the entire plant. All of these kinds of studies are being done right now in laboratories throughout the world with the idea of creating better crops that have more benefits for people.
Audience, you're listening to Skeptically Speaking. If you have questions about genetically modified food, Kevin Folta is the man to ask. Email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So what would you say that people are most concerned about when we're talking about genetic modification of food? Like, let's start with the effect on humans.
Well, that's probably what people are most concerned with, because there's a thought of that, well, maybe you're going to introduce new types of allergies. Or when you talk about developing these plants, you refer to herbicide, or let's say antibiotic resistance genes, or viral genes, or viral gene promoters. And admittedly, these are all really scary terms that we use, but they're essentially the tools of being able to modify and create the plants that we need to create. We use viral genes, sometimes such as viral promoters, because they express genes at a very high level. So if you have a beneficial protein in a plant, it's frequently expressed downstream of a viral promoter. To me, that doesn't scare me because I understand exactly what that means. But when you say those words or say viral promoter, it really conjures a different vision in the idea in the minds of the public. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we have a little bit of a PR problem here as a scientist dealing with GMO.
So is there any danger through ingesting?
And this is the problem, is that as a scientist, I can't tell you there isn't.
Okay.
All I can tell you is that there's no evidence that's been convincing and reproducible that says they're dangerous. And if you go to the internet, it'll scare you to death, because if you go to, say, Seeds of Deception, the website will list 65 cases where there's been specific harm to animals or humans. But none of those shows up when you look in PubMed or any of the refereed scientific literature. So there's a tremendous body of anecdotal evidence, and as many will remind you that the plural of anecdote is not data. We're missing any hard evidence that says conclusively that there's some sort of problem with GM food. To the opposite, right now, just about everybody is getting some degree of GM food in their diets. It's 90-some percent of soybeans, 70% of corn, tremendous amount, 90% of canola. All of these are extensively genetically modified with foreign genes. And humans, as well as livestock, have been consuming these almost daily. And there's no connection that can really be drawn between these crops and human health.
We have another question from the chat room.
From David Bloomberg, has there ever been a case of genetic engineering of food that turned out to be a danger to humans?
Not ever. That comes to mind.
Okay.
There's no smoking gun that comes to mind. There's one example that came from Brazil nuts, where they were trying to engineer some proteins from Brazil nut into another plant, and they realized that there was potential allergenicity because some people are allergic to Brazil nuts. The modification was a methionine-rich protein, and those studies ceased at that point, so they're never released into the public.
So what you're saying is this is basically scientific consensus at this point, like climate change.
Well, it's interesting contrast, because climate change is an issue where we have scientific consensus, but denial from a certain segment of the population. So we're still arguing about the problem there. The problem in GM food is that we need more food, it's higher quality, and we need to solve the fact that many people starve the world over or have insufficient calories or insufficient nutrition. We can agree on that problem, but now we're fighting over a solution, and that's what's really disturbing about this.
So what effect could GM foods have on that?
Well, there's many possibilities. When you look at the GM technologies that have already been deployed, such as BT cotton. BT cotton is cotton which has been engineered with a gene from Bacillus thuringiensis, a bacterium that makes a small protein that is species selective and works only on the gut of certain boring pests. And BT cotton has been enormously successful in India and in China, where it's decreased the amount of pesticides and herbicides that have to be applied to these crops tremendously. It was something like 78,000 tons of pesticide were not introduced into the environment because of the success of this particular genetic modification. And that's 1 year, and that's only in China. And that's the total amount of pesticide that's applied in California as a whole. So there's one really nice example of how by modifying this plant, kept this stuff out of our environment, kept the pesticides out, and made things entirely more healthful and hospitable for workers.
Now, one of the things we do hear a lot about is that it increases the yield so drastically in GM crops.
That tends to be true in most cases, in many cases, and that's certainly the case in GM cotton and in GM canola. If you look at papaya, is a sparkling case of yield increases. The papaya industry in Hawaii was almost decimated in the 1990s by papaya ring spot virus. In 1998, they brought the resistant, or the GE-modified resistant lines of papaya, and in 1 year went from the yield of maybe 26 million pounds in 1997 to about 40 million in 1998. And this was a direct, after this was introduced, and this was a direct attribute of the GE.
Well, I was reading something by the Union of Concerned Scientists, and that's a nonprofit science advocacy group. They published a report called Failure to Yield, and it stated that in nearly a 20-year record, genetically engineered crops had not increased yield substantially. So, and that's in the U.S. So are you familiar with that report?
Yes, I'm familiar with the report.
And, yeah, and what's your position?
Okay, and I can speak to that. The report picks the yield of corn and soybeans. And they really were speaking about, and I won't get into the weird nuts and bolts here, but they talk about intrinsic yield versus operational yield. They're splitting a lot of hairs in what they're calling yield to begin with. But let's just say, for instance, that they're exactly right, that there is no evidence of increased yield from GE of corn or cotton during that time span. There was a tremendous amount less pesticide applied to those plants. Maybe lower fertilizer requirements. Maybe that they were had longer shelf life. All of the other variables that could be introduced around GE were ignored in that study. Yield is one metric. Probably the largest attribute of environmental impact or environmental benefit from GE in those specific cases are that you're not dumping other pesticides like atrazine on the crops or telechlor or whatever else you use, but you're also saving a lot of soil erosion from not having to till all the time. These are other benefits that the Union of Concerned Scientists report neglected. They also failed to address the idea of how GE crops were increasingly spiking production in developing countries, such as the aforementioned cotton example.
We have a phone call. Go ahead, caller.
I was just wondering, with all the great effects of genetic engineering on all these crops and everything like that, why does it seem that it's only large industries that are funding this research rather than governments, or at least they're the ones who have the patents, it feels like?
It's an excellent question. And the reason is because they're the only ones that can afford it. And if you think that if you have something, a bone to pick with Monsanto or other big agribusiness, the best thing you can do is fight to deregulate GE restrictions. If universities could get in the business, if small biotech companies could have more access to this technology and its approval, you would see a surge of companies that were able to, and government and industry and university interests that were going into this business. In my laboratory, we have plants that we've devised just to do studies, just for strictly in laboratory use, and they could potentially have tremendous benefit in the field for the industry. But we look at them as an interesting curiosity and kind of a dead end because we could never afford to commercialize them. So it's the people with the deep pockets that can do this, and so that's why it's only a small number of companies that do.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. If you have questions about genetically modified food, Kevin Folta is on the line. Email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet Skeptical Radio. So I read an article this week on cloning animals for food. So how does that work?
Well, cloning for animals, and this is typically done with some cattle, and I don't know about as much for food, but mostly for milk production. I know it's more commonly done, but the cloning process is really just evacuating an animal's egg or harvesting eggs, evacuating those eggs, and then introducing nuclei from the animal that will be cloned. So essentially taking the genetic material from the animal that's going to be cloned and placing it into the environment of an animal that can be hospitable for its growth and development. Those new zygotes are then re-implanted or at least fostered in the laboratory for a while and then implanted back into livestock to generate, or whatever animal, whatever mammal, to generate a new clone. And it's done fairly commonly because you can have very elite animals that are the products of breeding, that to continue to breed them is a very long arduous process. It's incredibly expensive. This really shortcuts that whole process.
NPR was having a field day today because there was a cloned cattle issue in the UK. Have you heard about this?
Yes, briefly.
Several descendants of cloned cattle somehow found their way into the food supply. So it turns out that many people have already eaten these animals and are quite upset about that.
But if you've eaten a strawberry or you've eaten a banana, you've eaten a clone. It doesn't bother us to eat cloned plants, but it bothers us to eat cloned animals. In a way, it doesn't make sense to me, because you're getting almost a guarantee that what you're consuming is identical to another one. It almost seems like a preferential state in a lot of ways.
Well, that's what I was wondering. If there are no actual health dangers, and it's mostly pretty much an ew, that's weird issue, are there any other dangers at all?
Well, I think it's more of a ew issue. I think the reason that this is particularly a hot-button issue is because of Britain's previous problems with prion-related diseases, which were the infectious agents that were leading to a series of diseases like Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease and other problems that were prion-associated, the mad cow scare. And so when you start thinking about biotechnology in cows, that also hits kind of close to home for people, and I think it's more of a yuck factor than actual science.
Okay, so there's no other dangers, no biodiversity issues, no adverse effects for any other reason?
I think if you consider the biodiversity of cattle, it's an incredibly narrow genetic base relative to wild ancestors, and what you're consuming right now for natural purposes, essentially, you know, they're, while not being clonal for the most part, come from a very narrow set of genetics. Farmers are, and those who are farming both plant or breeding both plants and animals, are constantly looking for new sources of genetics that they can bring in to obtain hybrid vigor or strengthen their products. But that takes many years. You think about how long it takes to raise a cow from a calf to a breeding age cow and be able to score it for the traits of interest. It takes a long time. So cloning is just a way to shortcut that process.
And we have a question from the website.
I have heard the claim that genetically modified fish could escape into the wild, thus causing some danger to the native fish populations by taking them over or upsetting the gene pool in a way that could be harmful. Is this a matter of concern? And that's from Nicole Gugliucci.
Yeah, Nicole, it's a... Now, you can almost take the word fish out of that and replace it with your favorite genetically modified organism. The concern is always that something will escape containment and find its way into the wild and take over. And the reason that that's not so much a concern for scientists and people who really understand this is because the organisms that are escaping, in many cases, didn't belong there in the first place. So in plants, we think of this all the time, because if something escapes the field, the farmer's field, it usually doesn't fare very well. They require too much tender, loving care in order to survive. They need fertilizer. They need tilling. They need all the other very careful husbandry that you would require. You won't see something really gaining a competitive advantage unless it had some sort of, unless the gene that was inserted gave some sort of fitness or selectable advantage. So if you were giving a fish a gene that would help it live in different in colder waters, then maybe it could become a problem if it was introduced into cold water. Could potentially upset those ecosystems. But all of these are what-ifs, and all of them are maybes, and while plausible, haven't been demonstrated and are highly unlikely.
Well, on that note, on the keeping GM foods and non-GM foods separate, listener Victor... I'm going to totally mangle this, Victor. I apologize. Kamutsky sent us in a Science Daily release about the first study to show evidence of genetically modified plants in the wild, and that's specifically GM canola in North Dakota. And that study just came out today. And thanks to everybody who sent me that. I got that a billion times, but Victor was first. So what do you think of that study?
No, thank you for letting me address this. So if you were to go back... let's say 15 years before there was GE canola, you would probably be finding non-GE canola escaping the same kind of way, being found along roads, being found in planters at shopping malls, being found everywhere. When you're on the farm, you find volunteer plants, and you find you walk through your cornfield, you frequently will find something growing there, that another crop plant growing, maybe from a previous year, or something that was brought in by birds, or who knows. But it's not uncommon to find volunteer plants that are escaping their confines of their original field. It's not probably not unexpected then that you would find GE canola escaping, because most of the canola that's grown is GE. So it's by default what you're going to find. I think the part that made this story more interesting was that the GE canola that was studied, you would find evidence of multiple GE instances. So you'd find various genes from different genetic engineering events kind of stacking in single plants. I think there were two out of the series they tested that actually were showing this kind of stacked resistance or stacked evidence of resistance genes. What this means is that they're breeding with each other, that pollen is crossing, and that you're having plants being plants and making more plants. Again, this doesn't confer any selective advantage or any fitness to this canola. It's still a wimpy plant outside of the field, and it's among crop plants is a little bit better. It is a little more weedy than other crop plants, but can be managed by using mowing or any other kinds of or other herbicides to control it. So it's not anything to be too nervous about.
Well, what would be the worst case scenario then with that? Because we do hear this constantly. This is a huge danger presented by the media.
I think that it ties in with our old fear of the blob. You know, this idea of some sort of scientific project that escapes the laboratory and ends up wreaking havoc in nature. While I can put it on the radar as something that could plausibly occur, I mean, look at what happened with probably the best example is if you take other plants out of their natural environments and bring them here. Let's say bring them to our fields, which is just about everything that we grow. All of our crop plants are foreigners and didn't originate here. You don't find them growing and taking over. You just don't find it. You don't find maize growing everywhere or invading and destroying forests. Other examples where people have brought in kudzu, you know, for instance, and that certainly has caused quite a problem. It's not an issue for GE plants. It's an issue for plants that we have to be very careful about the ecology when we're bringing in different plants that can potentially be invasive. As long as the GE plants aren't selected and don't have increased fitness outside of the field context, there's a very, very minimal likelihood that they would cause any kind of problem once escaping containment.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we talk to author Christopher Ryan about his new book, Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. We'll talk about the most recent science on the development of human sexuality and how social norms compare to our biological impulses. And on Speaking Up, SkepTrack organizers Derek Colanduno and Robin Swoopy McCarthy give us a sneak peek at the skeptical events happening at this year's DragonCon. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm joined today by Dr. Kevin Folta, molecular biologist and associate professor in the Horticultural Sciences Department at the University of Florida. So, what's the cost to culture with GM foods? For example, there's been a lot of coverage about Terminator seeds. Can you explain how those work?
Sure. Well, Terminator technology, which I hope somebody in their PR office got fired over this one, was a modification which disallowed a farmer to maintain a successfully germinating next generation of seeds. So farmers traditionally, in many cases, have grown a crop and then brown bagged or have saved the seeds from that previous generation to use the next year. And that doesn't seem like much of a problem. Unfortunately, for those who oppose the technology, we've been doing this for years with hybrids. Hybrid plants, when first really started to be implemented in the early 1900s, brought tremendous benefits to farmers. And a number of companies started to make elite hybrids. They would come up with two parental lines that had wonderful, wonderful traits and then breed them together. And the offspring also, well, frequently would contain, in some cases, reflections of both parents that would be very elite seeds. And these could then be passed on to farmers who would then realize the benefits of both of those parental lines. Those parental lines were just about in all cases proprietary. So really, for years now, agribusiness has been creating, in quotes, Terminator technology. Because if you took those seeds off those hybrids and crossed them with themselves, the next generation would show genetic segregation, or that shuffling of the genetic deck, where really most of the plants would not be nearly as productive as either of the parents or that hybrid that was planted the year before. So hybrid technology was always allowing farmers, or allowing agribusiness or seed companies, to have some sort of proprietary control of their hard work and their germplasm. No one ever got upset about that until Monsanto started to do this with genetic modification.
So do you see any problems there? Because there's a number of them that could potentially be issues. There are societies that collect seeds as part of their culture, and they've been able to do this for years sustainably. So how are they affected?
No, absolutely. And societies that have collected seeds can continue to do that. And through understanding more about plant biology and by traditional breeding efforts, we'll come up with improved varieties that people may use and may continue to bag those seeds and use generation after generation. The question here comes to, does a company which is adding value to a crop that farmers are realizing, do they have a right to have some sort of control on their intellectual property? And I think, you know, we wouldn't be very successful at getting Coke to give their formula, or, you know, what's in the special sauce on a Big Mac. Somehow that kind of corporate knowledge is allowable and acceptable, but in this case, not. I think that most farmers who are saving their seeds, or who have heirloom varieties that they prefer, that they can have some sort of genetic reproducibility in the subsequent generations, that stuff's all still there, and people are still free to use that. They choose these other technologies because they're better in the context of their field, or have better yield, or better performance, or less herbicide. And in that way, they're preferred.
But at this point, Monsanto almost completely controls the seed industry, correct?
Well, Monsanto and its offshoots. There's a variety of other companies, but whether it's Seminis or other companies, they do have the majority of the seed market.
And we have another caller, and that's Paul from Edmonton.
Yeah, that's me. Hi. Maybe you could speak on the issue that GMO foods themselves perhaps are not inherently dangerous to health, but many are engineered so that they're more resistant to pesticides and herbicides. Those chemicals are implicated in things like cancer. You can reference the American Breast Cancer Fund for information on that. Thank you.
Okay, Paul. Engineering in something like glyphosate has been done, and glyphosate resistance is very effective. And the glyphosate herbicide is, as far as herbicides go, really not that toxic. It has about the same LD50 or lethality in a test tube or in an animal system as salt. It would take about a cup of the stuff, or a half a cup of it, to drink it to kill you. It's a really relatively benign, and it breaks down in the environment very quickly. So if you're going to spray a Roundup Ready crop with glyphosate, or a conventionally grown crop with atrazine or whatever else you might use, the environmental impacts are tremendously lower. Even organic crops that are allowed in organic systems, you're allowed to use certain herbicides, or pesticides, and those can be quite toxic too, and have non-target effects. I'm not familiar with any really strong evidence that glyphosate in the doses that are used has any effect on human health, any strong document. And I need to check that out, but I'm unaware of anything.
And we have another question from the website.
If you wanted to produce a genetic change that would render a food unsafe, how hard would that be? And what does that tell us about how likely we are to do so by accident?
Okay. You might want to trace that email to find out who sent it. I think that if you were asking me to create something dangerous, I might be reminded that plants have a wonderful ability to produce dangerous and toxic compounds on their own. So something like ricin from castor beans is a tremendously toxic protein. Something like canotoxin from jack beans, aberrin from rosemary pea. There's a wide variety of very toxic compounds that plants make naturally. And I think that that increasing something like that, well, that would be an easy one because it's already naturally there. So how would you modify it either through GE or by breeding to make them more potent? Possibly could be done. I guess the other part of the question was, what is the possibility of this happening by accident, by consequence of modification? And I would say the answer is virtually zero. And the reason is that when you genetically modify something through gene manipulation, you know, by adding or taking out genes, you know exactly what that target is. You know how to trace it. You know how to measure it. And you know how to test for it. You know how to test for its unintended consequences. So plants produce a lot of really bad stuff on their own. Nightshades are toxic. So by knowing exactly what we're placing in actually gives us a tremendous amount of control over other methods of just maybe breeding or other wide crosses that could introduce deleterious effects.
And we have a ridiculous number of questions from the website. We'll go to the next one.
University of Arizona entomologists recently engineered a mosquito that can't transmit malaria, and they're hoping to eventually replace wild populations of mosquitoes that carry the disease. Are there any food, plants, or animals being deliberately designed to try and replace native varieties?
Yeah, that's a good question. And there have been a number of examples of this. This is a very good one, the mosquito. But nothing else comes to mind right off the top of my head in terms of being designed to specifically replace something else.
And another question from the website.
I've read that scientists are trying to grow meat in the lab. This seems like it would go a long way towards alleviating some of the angst around eating animals, as well as reducing the carbon footprint of industrial livestock production. Where are we with this?
Yeah, that was a study from the Netherlands where they were able to use pig muscle cells in culture and get them to proliferate. The problem there is that it's really more science fiction at this point. You have to get all the nutrients that are going in there from somewhere. You have to get the compounds that this tissue culture is needing from somewhere. Animals get that when they eat other plants or animals. So you have to have some sort of media that has to be manufactured, has to be shipped. The idea of farming in petri dishes probably is still a little bit science fiction.
And another question from the website.
What about the problem of pleiotropy? If one gene can have more than one phenotypic effect, how confident can we be about the effects of changing a single gene?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. And to kind of paraphrase that, what the listener is writing is, how do you change one gene and be sure that you're not having any other long-term developmental consequences or other changes that are unintended? And the answer is, you don't know that, but you don't know that from traditional breeding either. What's nice about GE is that you can do a lot of really nice studies these days and nice assays to be able to test for what other genes or what other proteins or what other metabolic processes have been affected in the transgenic versus the non-transgenic plant. So in a way, again, by knowing our target allows us to know and screen for any potential pleiotropic effects.
And another question from the website.
What do you think about organic farming and NOP standards that forbid transgenic plants?
And this is a really good question, too, because the thing I love about organic farming is the idea is that it's low input. We're being good environmental stewards. We're taking care of the planet. We're taking care of the people. That's a really important part of organic food and organic farming. The problem is that the organic standards, by eliminating transgenics, are entirely short-sighted, because the fact that you may be able to even help the environment even more or have greater yield or replace some conventional farming or have better outcomes for workers by introducing GE, by eliminating that is really rather short-sighted. That it would be really great if people who define the organic standards could reconsider that one, because I see, if we had to look in the looking glass or in the crystal ball 50 years down the road, I see the best of organic culture and the best of organic farming meshing very well with transgenic crops.
And another question from the website.
What about engineering in the other direction? Why not try to make it possible for people or livestock to photosynthesize so they don't have to eat at all?
Yeah, that's another one that comes from the science fiction file. Sure, it would be a great idea, but the idea is that plants and animals split off so long ago evolutionarily that they have very specific mechanisms, very specific physiology, cellular processes that could never be simply transplanted from one to another. I say that, and I'll listen to this in 40 years and go, well, that person was on to something. But to me, it seems like a little bit far out at this point.
And this is our last question that we have time for. I'd like to point out, you guys are wonderful. We had just an amazing amount of questions this week, and there's no way that it's humanly possible to get to all of them. Go ahead.
I always look forward to listening to scientists in a specialty speak on subjects that should not be controversial. Could you address your views on modern Luddism with regard to biotechnologies, possible gross waste recycling, CO2 and sewage, and nuclear technologies? That's from
okay.
Henk Vandergast.
That's broad.
Oh, I love that one, though. Really, I think what we have to be very careful of is when we decide that we don't need new technology because everything is convenient. We have enough calories. We can flip on a light switch and get energy we want. We can still afford to pollute the planet. Whether we like it or not, we're doing it. We need new technology, and we need to embrace new technology. And people who are anti-technology, they tend to be the people who don't need the new technology because they have plenty of the old technology. What we want to do is use the new technologies like nuclear power, GE crops, to be able to expand what people throughout the world can get and enjoy a better standard of living.
And we are out of time, Kevin. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
So do visit Kevin at kevinfolta.com and visit us at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, follow the links to our Facebook page, to Twitter, to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Hi, everyone. This is Nicole Gallucci from One Astronomer's Noise at noisyastronomer.com. I've made it a point to share science with as many people as I can, and sometimes it happens in interesting ways. One time, a family member emailed me asking, "What's up with that magnetic field thing in 2012? Are we all doomed?" Some of my coworkers were talking about it, and I thought you were the person to ask. Well, sure, I happily explained as best I could what the Earth's magnetic field is, how it may flip its poles now and again over the course of geologic history, why that's probably not something we have to worry about, and why the 2012 doomsday scenarios are based on, well, nothing. Not only did I ease her fears, but she printed out the email and passed it around the lunchroom the next day. Hopefully I taught a little science and planted some seeds of skepticism that day. The point is, all of us can do outreach. We may not have the biggest audience or garner the most attention, but every person has a close circle with whom they can share their passion for science and learning, or advance critical thinking skills. And after all, why not start with the people you care about the most?
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking on mind reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is recorded at CJSR in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our on-air producer is Michael Harrison. Our sound technician is Ryan Bromsgrove. Post-production editing by K.O. Myers. Theme song by rapper A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Shell.